Here, it's our book of the week. Toby Jones reads from Olivier, Philip Ziegler's new biography of Laurence Olivier.
The establishment of the English Stage Company at the Royal Court in 1956 profoundly affected the development of the British theatre, and Olivier, feeling he had got into a rut, sought some new experience there. He went to see John Osborne's Look Back in Anger, a ferociously entertaining assault on patriotism, paternalism, and all the values of the middle classes which Olivier held dear. He disliked the play, and told Arthur Miller, "It's just a lot of bitter rattling on about conditions." Although he added, "Some people think it's a fairly good satire." But he admired Osborne, and went on to ask him if he would consider writing a play with a part suitable for him. Osborne's The Entertainer, with Olivier taking the role of failing musical performer Archie Rice, was a sensation when it opened at the Court the following year. "It came nearer to the true concept of tragedy than any other play I've been in," Olivier told a friend, "the original purpose of which, as laid down by the ancient Greeks, was to give the audience a good kick in the stomach and make it think again." Before the first night, he sent an effusive letter to Osborne. "Thank you for the most deeply engaging part, perhaps barring only Macbeth and Lear, that I can remember." The critics were left struggling for superlatives. "You will not see more magnificent acting than this anywhere in the world," wrote Harold Hobson. Vivian Leigh attended rehearsals, slipping in at the back of the stalls and making no attempt to advertise her presence. No doubt she paid particular attention to Dorothy Chutin, Olivier's daughter on the stage, and, as she no doubt knew, his mistress of it. But she would have more cause to take note a few months later, when Chutin withdrew to be replaced by the rising star of the Royal Court, Joan Plowright. By the time The Entertainer opened in New York, they were most evidently in love. "I am in touch with the real beauty of happiness at last," Olivier told his son Tarquin. Plowright knew that his marriage must be near its end, but she knew too of Lee's instability and Olivier's desire to avoid precipitating a crisis. Things were to move slowly and uncertainly. In the ensuing 4 years, though he would do 4 more plays, 4 cinema films and 2 for television, these were in Olivier's mind secondary to a new development in which he was resolved to be associated: the opening of the National Theatre. There had been talk of it since the mid-19th century. Foundation stones had been laid, dug up, and relaid. The founding and development of the Shakespeare Memorial Theatre in Stratford had clouded the issue, although the London County Council had made a site available on the South Bank, and the government had pledged support. Still, there was quibbling, haggling, one step back for every 2 forward. Without the resolute pressure of a group of devotees, notably Oliver Littleton, the process would have stalled indefinitely. The trustees, including Lord Esher, felt they needed someone from the theatrical profession to lend their expertise as the first director of the National Theatre. It would have to be someone of almost heroic stature, infinitely patient, of unassailable theatrical reputation, but also sufficiently flexible to absorb the ideas and style of the new generation. By early 1960, the fact that Olivier would be the first director had been agreed. Soon after, Vivian Leigh, inexplicably and without warning, announced to the world that her husband had asked her for a divorce in order that he might marry Joan Plowright, and that she would accede to his wishes. This was, of course, welcome to Olivier, despite the hurricane of gossip which followed. When the decree absolute came through in March 1961, Olivier and Joan Plowright were in the United States. A fortnight later they married, in strictest privacy. "Joan is a very natural and splendidly earthy young woman," Olivier told Tarquin. And if I am to make her happy, she's simply got to have children, that's all. She's that type. In due course, they would have three children together, Richard, Tamsin, and Mary-Kate. They were an enormously happy couple. Olivier was now ready to take up his appointment as the first director of the National. But the government had worked on the preliminary assumption that there would be some sort of merger between the RSC in Stratford and the new National Theatre, which would be loosely based on the repertory style of the Old Vic. I don't believe there's enough talent in this country for two major classical theatres to be operating properly, said Peter Hall, now head of a resurgent RSC. It is essential that this theatre in some way amalgamates with it. But two strong-minded individuals were involved, and each was reluctant to surrender any real authority to the other. Eventually, Hall withdrew from the negotiations, which ended in acrimony. On the 10th of October 1962, Olivier attended his first meeting of the National Theatre Board as director-designate. His annual salary had been agreed at just £5,000, and he was to be given a period of leave each year in which he could make films or do whatever else he wanted, a reasonable provision given the financial sacrifice he was making. But the National Theatre was at the heart of his life. He identified himself wholly with it, loving it, with the fierce pride of an artist surveying his own creation. He was owned by the National, yet he owned it. Once, in the not-so-small hours of the morning, after a heavy drinking session, Olivier announced to his wife in stentorian voice, "There'd be no National Theatre if it wasn't for me." "Come on, Larry, it's time you went to bed," said Joan. The burden of running the National was made the greater by his determination from the start to concern himself with every aspect of its existence. Delegation was not a word that came easily to Olivier. He wrote petulant board minutes about the low quality of the lavatory paper in the staff toilets, and inquired whether it was necessary to have so many lights burning in the entrance hall. "There were occasions when you thought, 'Will there ever be any peace?'" said Rupert Rhymes, the theatre manager. Early on, determined to create a company and then a theatre, Olivier poached two of the Royal Court's brilliant young directors, William Gaskell and John Dexter. This was an acceptance of the new world that he had ventured into with the Entertainer. "I wanted people who were prepared to outgun me," Olivier wrote. "I wanted the cream of British theatre, and I think I got it." The National was to recruit some of the court's most promising young actors, including Plowright, Anthony Hopkins, Maggie Smith, Michael Gambon and Derek Jacobi, as well as invite dramatists who had first written for the court to produce work for them. The first production at the National Theatre was scheduled to begin in October 1963. Olivier had to produce from scratch, not just a company that would be capable of acting a vast range of contemporary and classical drama, but also an organisation that would sustain that company, provide the theatre and facilities, promote the productions. It was the work of the traditional actor-manager, but conducted on an industrial scale. And on top of that, he had to play a primary role in the planning and building of the new theatre to which the company would move in the not-too-distant future. The Old Vic, where they were based at the time, provided an adequate auditorium, but it did not have the office space required for such an enterprise. A gaggle of squalid, prefab huts grew up nearby, with low ceilings and such thin walls that when Olivier was in full cry, his voice could be heard in all the nearby offices. The miracle of operating efficiently and sustaining morale in such circumstances would never have happened without Olivier's leadership and inspiration. In a way, it was an act. Olivier, the all-encompassing director, was as much a creation of his will and skill as Olivier playing Othello or Astroff. Yet it was an act that found its inspiration in his love for and pride in the company, and his conviction that the National was the greatest company in the world. The choice of Hamlet as the first production, starring Peter O'Toole, fresh from his vast success in Lawrence of Arabia, was a resounding statement that the National Theatre was not going to leave Shakespeare to Stratford. This could not be its principal raison d'être, however. Olivier realised that his choice of plays over the first year was going to shape the public's perception of the theatre. When it came to it, there were two Shakespeares, the other being Olivier's renowned Othello, a Shaw, a Sophocles, and an Ibsen, as well as a Chekhov, Hobson's Choice, The Recruiting Officer, Andorra by Max Frisch, and Samuel Beckett's Play. The National got off to a sensational start. The success of the company was firmly established, it was declared at a board meeting, and it was thanks, first of all, and is thanks, to Sir Laurence Olivier. He has been the mainspring of all our activities. The board offered him an extension of his contract to July 1973, with a view to him still being director when the new theatre on the South Bank was opened. But by the end of 1970, there was something of a palace revolution, as the company was beset with financial difficulties and creative doldrums. "Difficult phase at the NT," was the headline in the Evening Standard. Aged 65, Olivier was a man acutely aware of his limitations. For most of his life he had believed that anything was possible. Now he accepted that it was not, and that what powers he had left were fast diminishing. Most difficult of all for an actor, his memory was not what it had been, and his powers of concentration were waning. His contract was coming to an end, but he still wanted to control the future of his beloved theatre. Somehow he was surprised when the board put forward the name of Peter Hall as the next director. To most people, Hall seemed the obvious candidate, and it was not as if the idea was new to Olivier. He had been mooted for some time. The provision for this appointment was that Olivier should pronounce himself happy with Hall's succession. Hall also said he would not take the job except with Olivier's blessing. Olivier, stung by the board's decision over his head, eventually accepted the inevitable, made polite noises, and retired to brood. It was Olivier's singular accomplishment to start with nothing and to end with a proud and passionately united body. People have claimed that Olivier's National Theatre was the last proud flourish of the actor-manager, rather than the first manifestation of the big business institution which would be needed as the 20th century wore towards its end. It might be fairest to see it as a halfway house. Olivier's National Theatre could not have survived in the form in which he had fashioned it, but nor could the National of today have existed but for the exuberance and dynamic energy of Olivier's creation. There would be some sort of National Theatre today, even if there had been no Olivier. But if there had been no Olivier, the triumphant impetus which carried it all the way into the new millennium would have been lacking. The debt owed to him by the British Theatre is inestimable.
Toby Jones has been reading extracts from Olivier by Philip Ziegler. The book was abridged and directed by Eileen Horn, produced by Clive Brill, and it was a Pacificus production for BBC Radio 4. Our next book of the week is published to mark 50 years since the death of a US president. The Letters of John F. Kennedy begins on Monday morning at 9:45.
162 BPM.
John Wilson returns to the BBC's Maida Vale studios.
In the series Master Tapes, I take musicians back to the making of a key album in their career.
A new series of Radio 4's Master Tapes.
What we're trying to get at is what was happening in the mind of a songwriter when they were making that album.
Beginning with an album that defined an artist.
He's a young lad from Stoke-on-Trent. Give it up for Mr. Robbie Williams.
This Monday night at 11 on BBC Radio 4.
Back to today, and in a couple of minutes, it's Woman's Hour.